It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, May 6th. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Keep listening for in-depth stories on an accidental shooting death in Minneapolis, more bad news from the Iron Range, the pitch for safe turkey eating, the effort to attract a college football national championship to Minnesota, and an operating medical marijuana manufacturing facility in the state. Also, a dark anniversary in Minnesota weather history. First, though, a BNSF oil train derailed this morning in a small North Dakota town. The train was heading east through Heimdall in central North Dakota when several cars derailed and caught fire. Janelle Pepley is a spokeswoman for the Wells County Sheriff's Office.
It's a Burlington Northern train, 109 cars carrying crude oil. 6 to 7 cars have derailed. The fire is actively burning. There are no injuries. The town of Heimdall and surrounding farmsteads have been evacuated.
The derailment occurred about a quarter mile east of the town, according to local residents, in a swampy area. BNSF responders separated the burning cars from the rest of the train. Hazmat teams from Grand Forks and Devil's Lake are on standby assisting local fire crews there. BNSF says the derailment involved a newer class of tank cars designed to have enhanced safety features. A University of Minnesota student reported being raped last weekend in her University Avenue dorm room. Alex Friedrich has more.
University spokesman Tim Bussey says the 18-year-old freshman encountered two men in her dorm hallway Sunday, sometime between 12:45 and 1:30 a.m.
She was on her way to the bathroom. They, I think, came up the stairs and said hello to her and initiated the conversation.
Bussey had no details of the conversation, but said they offered to walk her back to her room. Once there, one of them threatened her with a knife and then both sexually assaulted her. On Monday, the woman reported the assault to campus police, who are now investigating. Police say the woman does not know her attackers and said detailed descriptions of them are not available. Bussey says he doesn't know whether the men were students. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minneapolis Area Association of Realtors says home buying is up sharply in the Twin Cities. Matt Sepik reports.
The group says pending sales for February and March were the highest in a decade, and in the last full week of April, the number of pending sales topped 1,600, up 39% over the same time in 2014. Pat Paulson with Exit Realty is a past president of the association and says this April was even stronger than April of 2010, when the imminent expiration of an $8,000 federal tax credit spurred sales.
This latest week that came out surpassed that even. And so we pretty much have to go back to 2005 before we find anything comparable.
Paulson says strong demand combined with relatively low housing inventory is continuing to push prices up. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The parents of a 15-year-old North Minneapolis boy are planning his funeral. Brandon Wren was shot and killed in his home as he and his brother apparently played with a gun they found in a park. Peter Cox talked with Brandon's stepmother and has this story.
Tamika Wren says the family had just finished dinner when she told the boys to go put their clothes in the washing machine and get ready for school the next morning.
And he was laughing, cracking up, like, I am. Always laughing so much. Always playing so much. Now you're playing with a damn gun.
She says Brandon and his 14-year-old brother were playing with a gun when it went off. The Hennepin County Medical Examiner reported yesterday Brandon Wren died of a gunshot wound to the neck at his home late Sunday night.
I had to hold one son while he died, and now I got to hold another son to make it through this. I can't even weigh it out.
Wren said the boys found the gun in nearby Falwell Park and brought it home in a backpack. Minneapolis police spokesman John Elder says officers were called to the home on a report of a shot fired.
Officers responded and located a juvenile male who was deceased from what appeared to be a gunshot wound. We interviewed people at the residence, and preliminary investigation yields that this may be an accidental shooting.
Police are still investigating what happened. Tamika Wren says three other siblings and their father were also in the house at the time of the shooting. She was on the phone with a police dispatcher as she held Brandon.
And then I told the police, never mind, because I felt his last breath in my arms, so no reason to rush. Please send a coroner. Pick my son up off my floor.
It has been a difficult several weeks for the family. In late April, Brandon's sister Tiffany Scott died of cancer. They buried her Saturday. Brandon was a freshman at Patrick Henry High School and played basketball in a Minneapolis Police Activities League. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A homegrown company that pioneered a new form of iron ore mining in northeastern Minnesota filed for bankruptcy protection yesterday. But that might not be as bad as it sounds. Magnetation says the restructuring will allow the company to keep operating during a global downturn in the iron ore industry, and that has already led to over 1,000 layoffs on the Iron Range. Dan Crocker reports.
Magnetation was born from the waste of over 100 years of iron ore mining in northern Minnesota. The company devised an innovative technology to process the tailings thrown away by old mining companies into an iron ore concentrate that can be used to make steel. Since its founding in 2006, the company has quickly expanded. It's built four plants on the Iron Range, plus a taconite pellet plant in Indiana. Magnetation completed its newest and biggest plant near Grand Rapids just before the new year. President Matt Lettinen says that's right when the global price of iron ore was tumbling to record lows.
We're a young company without deep pockets. We invested heavily in northern Minnesota, and the iron ore prices crashed at just the wrong time for us.
Lettinen says the company's bankruptcy restructuring and $64 million in new capital investment from its senior bondholders will allow Magnetation to survive. The company employs about 300 people on the Iron Range.
The low iron ore prices have put a strain on all of the iron ore producers here in the range. Magnetation is no different. And without this new financing, without this reorganization process, the prospect of us operating would have been in question.
Last month, the price of iron ore plunged to under $50 a ton, down from $190 a ton in 2011. Iron ore production globally has soared, while demand, especially in China, is way down. That's led to a surge of cheap imports into the U.S., which has hurt American steelmakers. As a result, U.S. Steel has announced about 1,100 layoffs at its two mines on the Iron Range. Magnetation closed down one of its plants this winter. Just this week, Cliffs Natural Resources announced 95 layoffs at its five mines in Minnesota and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach says he worries high-cost producers could be driven out of business.
This bankruptcy is just another example, I think, of the challenges that the global iron business is presenting to Minnesota.
But Matt Lettinen says Magnetation is positioned well for the future. He says the company benefits from low costs because it doesn't have to haul and crush tons of rock like conventional mines do. College of St. Scholastica economist Tony Barrett says he doesn't see the bankruptcy filing as necessarily bad news.
I see this as a fairly natural stage of development for a company that did expand rapidly, but is in an industry that's under stress. Those are the companies that are vulnerable, the new ones trying new technology. This is not unexpected.
But an infusion of new capital from investors, Barrett warns, usually comes with strings attached. State Representative Tom Ansells worries that will likely mean a loss of what makes Magnetation unique among Iron Range mining companies, local control.
It feels to me that much of the decision-making at the highest levels will not be made by Iron Range entrepreneurs, but will be made by the people who have the financial interest in this company.
Magnetation's largest customer, AK Steel, currently owns a 49.9% stake in the company. President Matt Lettinen says the bankruptcy proceedings, quote, may result in our current ownership structure being changed. Economist Tony Barrett says that's the nature of the beast.
You have a very capital-intensive industry. You need that money. It's got to come from somewhere. And that's, you know, outside our neighborhood.
Northern Minnesota legislators have introduced proposals to help with some of those high capital costs. One would lower the price for electricity. Another, says Tom Ansells, could lower royalty payments when companies mine state-owned minerals.
But by and large, 90% of the problem that Minnesota's taconite industry is faced with is federal and international, involving the global marketplace.
A global marketplace that is having severe local effects on Minnesota's Iron Range. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Governor Mark Dayton says he doesn't see much momentum at the state legislature this year to adopt new federal standards for driver's licenses. Catherine Richard reports.
A delay could cause trouble next year when the Department of Homeland Security says security officials may prevent people from states that aren't in compliance from boarding airplanes. Governor Mark Dayton said he expects the federal government to delay the rules, but the driver's license issue will be a priority for him next year.
Yes, sir. Telling Minnesotans they can't get an airplane, something's going to happen.
Congress passed what's known as the Real ID Act in 2005 to prevent terrorists from entering federal buildings, nuclear plants, and airplanes. Minnesota is one of only six states and territories that hasn't acted on the federal law. In 2009, former Governor Tim Pawlenty signed into law a bill that banned the state from adopting the new rules because of privacy and cost concerns. Catherine Richert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Hundreds of people lined up on the lawn of the state capitol yesterday for free turkey burgers. The cookout was a way for some Minnesota lawmakers to show their support for the state's turkey industry as it faces the avian flu outbreak. Here's Tim Pugmire.
Okay, Linda, do you want pickles or...
Legislators from the state's turkey-growing areas have been working together on several bills aimed at fighting the spread of avian influenza and helping the affected farmers. Millions of turkeys have already been lost. Republican Representative Dave Baker of Willmar said grilling 600 turkey burgers was a way to send an important message.
This thing is getting out of hand, but we want to make sure people know around the state of Minnesota that turkey is really safe, and we need to support our industry and our growers by buying more turkey.
Baker and other members of the Republican Rural Caucus chipped in to buy the food and organize the cookout. The event came a day after the Minnesota House passed an agriculture finance bill that includes several bird flu provisions. The measure allocates more than $6 million for the state agencies responding to the crisis. There's also money for low-interest loans to farmers and extended unemployment benefits for farm workers. The bill also opens the door for the state to potentially reimburse farmers for lost flocks. It's been a moving target for lawmakers, but Baker said there's been overwhelming bipartisan support for the effort.
For members like us that are in the thick of it and in the epicenter out in west central Minnesota, I have found the support to be enormous. It's been heartfelt, and we're really grateful for that.
Another rural legislator, Republican Representative Tim Miller of Prinsburg, said he wants to make sure the state is ready to respond to the long-term impact of the outbreak.
We want to make sure that we do this right. I think we've handled the upfront crisis. Now it's making the right decisions moving forward.
The proposed spending in the agriculture bill follows an emergency allocation of $900,000 that DFL Governor Mark Dayton already signed into law. Dayton and House Speaker Kurt Dowd attended the cookout and were among those helping to grill and serve turkey burgers. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Minnesota is looking to land yet another major event for the yet-to-be-opened Viking Stadium in downtown Minneapolis. Governor Dayton was joined by a host of business leaders and University of Minnesota football coach Jerry Kill yesterday to announce that they are bidding to host the College Football National Championship game in 2020. But as Tom Scheck reports, some lawmakers are wary of the request for public subsidies that come along with the event.
The new Viking Stadium doesn't open until next summer, but its booking sheet is getting full. In 2018, the Super Bowl will be played there. In 2019, the NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four will tip off in the stadium. Now, the state is looking to bring the College Football Playoff National Championship to Minneapolis in 2020. Governor Dayton said landing the football championship would be frosting on the cake for the new stadium.
It's a tremendous event, and it will get even bigger over the next 5 years, and this will be something we'll be very proud. And once again, everybody around the country and part of the world is going to be looking and see this is in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
The event is relatively new for college football. This year was the first time four Division I teams faced off in a playoff and an eventual national championship game. That game garnered the largest audience in cable TV history with 33 million viewers tuning in. University of Minnesota football coach Jerry Kill said college football fans appreciate that they went to a new system instead of picking a champion through a series of bowl games that relied on sports writers and computer rankings.
That's why they've gone to it, to find a true national championship game and a national champion playing it on the field, not by computer, so to speak.
If Minnesota wins its bid, it will be the first time the event will not be held in a southern state. And event organizers say they hope landing the game will let the public know that Minnesota thrives even in the cold winter months. Michelle Kelm-Helgen, chair of the Metropolitan Sports Facility Authority that oversees the Viking Stadium, said she doesn't know what other cities will attempt to land the game, but she's hopeful Minnesota will be in the running.
The college football championship people have been very clear that they want to look at some what they call non-traditional cities. And so they have given a pretty strong signal that they are looking to go other places than just the South.
Organizers say they expect to raise between $8 and $12 million to host the event. Kelm-Helgen said the bid package will include a sales tax exemption on tickets and possibly include other subsidies. The NFL is in line to receive a similar tax break for the Super Bowl. Those tax breaks upset several lawmakers who say the Viking Stadium was already built with $500 million in taxpayer money. Republican Senator Brandon Peterson of Andover said event organizers will keep asking for tax breaks as long as lawmakers are willing to give them away.
It's just gotten to the point of ridiculousness, but it's also not surprising if we continue to grant it to everybody who asks.
Peterson said he's also upset that lawmakers are asked to approve the tax breaks for the event only after the organizing committee promises them. He said that it's almost impossible for some lawmakers to say no at that point. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
Minnesota is just 8 weeks from the start of a new era in health care. Medical marijuana will be legal as of July the 1st. One of the providers of the drug has a manufacturing facility up and running in Otsego, and NPR's Tim Nelson went inside to check it out.
Make no mistake, although medical marijuana may soon be available across Minnesota, the federal government still considers it illegal. That's why Minnesota Medical Solutions keeps its product under lock and key. That's in a greenhouse and production facility in Otsego, about 40 miles northwest of downtown Minneapolis. The building is one of two production facilities licensed by the state. It's tucked out of sight and surrounded by a fence topped with barbed wire. Ron Owens used to work for the Secret Service and is in charge of the security. He calls it casino grade.
We are armed continually with security 24/7 on site, and we have constant surveillance on not only just our facility, but the dispensaries as well.
Inside, there are rows and rows of marijuana plants, from clippings taking root to huge palm-sized buds growing on shoulder-high stalks. Kyle Kingsley, a Minneapolis doctor, is the operation CEO. Yesterday, he led a media tour of the 15,000-square-foot facility with more than 4,000 plants.
So, guys, we're starting at the beginning of the process here, and for the medicine that we're making, the start of the cannabis plant is the cutting and cloning process. So if you look at these small plants that we have here, they've been cut from a larger mother plant. And so you can see this is where all of our plants start.
The cuttings spend a few weeks there growing roots. They move into hydroponic trays and then get transplanted into larger pots. Kingsley says they're exposed to light around the clock at this stage to make the plants grow as big as possible. After that, they're moved into huge greenhouses.
This is the flowering room. We're relying on natural sunlight with the greenhouse here, as you can see. From about this time until the end of September, we're going to have almost no supplemental lighting. We use natural sunlight. You can see there's also blackout capabilities in the greenhouse because we want 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark to stimulate the bud production, the flower production.
The buds have the active ingredients. They're harvested and run through a rack of tubes and pipes using what's called supercritical CO2 extraction. It's high-pressure carbon dioxide that separates the chemicals in the plants. Medical marijuana providers are after two of them. THC, that's the one that makes you high. CBD, or cannabidiol, is the other. Again, Kyle Kingsley.
So THC is going to be very helpful for people with cachexia or wasting, people with decreased appetite, people at the end of life. Somebody with pancreatic cancer can go from not eating for weeks to eating a meal a day. So CBD is the most famous use for that is the use of for seizures in kids.
Those compounds are made into pills, oils, and sprays depending on the preference of the patients. The drugs are stored in a giant concrete bank-like vault before being distributed to dispensaries where patients or their families can pick them up. Kim Kelsey of Excelsior says she wants it for her 23-year-old son who suffers from life-threatening seizures. She was one of the proponents to legalize medical cannabis and was also getting a first look at the facility.
It's given us the first hope that we've had in a really, 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 really long time.
She concedes it's just that at this point, hope. She doesn't know what benefit it will offer her son and says it's unlikely to end his need for conventional anti-seizure medication, but she wants to try.
Yes, we want a miracle. Who doesn't when you have a sick child or, you know, deal with this for so long? But somebody, everybody in the state of Minnesota will know somebody or be related to somebody that will be able to benefit.
MinMed's first dispensary is set to open in downtown Minneapolis on July 1st. Three more will come in the weeks that follow. Another company, Leafline Labs, has a facility in Cottage Grove and is expected to open dispensaries in Eagan and St. Cloud in July. Two more will follow in the next year. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Otsego.
5 decades ago today, tornadoes pummeled the region. Kathy Werzer talked about it this morning.
50 years ago today, May 6th, 1965, the Twin Cities was hit by the biggest tornado outbreak in its history. Here's what some of the live coverage sounded like that evening on WCCO Radio, where Charlie Boone and Dick Chapman were on the air.
Just spoke of, actually inside of those two gentlemen.
We've got a report right now, passed through Fridley. Go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
This is Robert Park in Fridley. The funnel touched down at the Fridley Junior High School and tore one the roof off the gymnasium and blew in the east side of the building, but no one was hurt. I just came from there, and none of the children assembled for the spring carnival were injured.
All right. Thank you, sir. Obviously.
You're welcome.
Righto. Now let me indicate here with our latest report from the Twin Cities Weather Bureau why we're getting so many reports from all over. It's because there may be as many as 5 funnels in the Twin City area right now.
Our meteorologist, Paul Huttner, was not a radio broadcaster back then. He was just a small boy, but he remembers the storm well because one of the tornadoes came very close to destroying his family's house in Deep Haven. I'm presuming, my friend, you were in the basement, as many of us were that night.
Well, we were eventually, but it's interesting, Kathy, we were not in the basement originally. It was, after school, early evening, and we were outside. The hail was coming down, these huge hailstones as big as your fist, and we were out there grabbing it, and we actually had my older brother's football helmets on to protect ourselves from the hail and putting it in bowls to put it in the freezer. The back door flies open. My mom comes screaming, "You kids get inside. Your father called. He said there's a tornado coming." My father worked at the Minneapolis City Hall, and he was near the police area there, and they had radios, of course, and the radio chatter was saying there were tornadoes on the ground heading for the Deep Haven area. And so we went into the basement, and I watched this thing pass with the swirling sky, and our home was undamaged. We were about a half a mile from that Deep Haven tornado, but we drove over there the next day and saw the devastation from an F4 tornado, and well, let's just say it left quite an impression on me.
No kidding. And this really was a line of them, just kind of one after the next of 6 total, which in these were powerful tornadoes.
They were. 4 of them, Kathy, were F4 tornadoes, winds approaching 200 miles an hour. So in the old Fujita scale, that's where they came down. And, you know, the Weather Service says 13 deaths that day from the 6 tornadoes. And the first one touched down around 6:08. It was east of Cologne in Carver County. That one killed 3 people and moved up toward Minnetrista. The second one was the tornado near our house. It started in Chanhassen near Lake Susan, traveled north through the Christmas Lake area, just east of Excelsior, and then into Deep Haven. Third tornado was also in parts of Sibley County, Western Prairie, McLeod County. Number 4. Was near Green Island, Sibley County. And then there were actually 2 tornadoes that hit Fridley that day. The first one touched down at 7:06. The second one touched down at 8:14. Kathy, that one was on the ground for almost 45 minutes.
You know, did you recall, the National Weather Service says it was the first time in Twin Cities history that the civil defense sirens were used for severe weather. Do you remember hearing any sirens?
I think I do, yes. I mean, that part of it's a little foggy for me, but I think I remember hearing the sirens either just as or once we got to the basement. So that's a first. That kind of pioneered some weather coverage and warning coverage for Minnesota. Also, really, the WCCO radio broadcasts that day were sort of a first, where they were on the air live forecasting and warning for this severe weather event. So it really was sort of an innovative day by some quick-thinking people who blew the sirens and the U.S. Weather Bureau before the National Weather Service and really saved a lot of lives that day, I think.
My friend Charlie Boone talks about that night along with Dick Chapman and the staff, and they were using maps trying to track these tornadoes using folks calling in at the time. Did the storm change the way we prepare for severe weather going forward?
It did indeed. I think we got a lot more aggressive about severe weather coverage from a broadcast media standpoint. Remember, we really didn't have on-air meteorologists back then. That changed as we moved forward into the late 60s and 70s. And, you know, the Twin Cities has benefited, I think, as a result of that over the years.
Amazing night. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
That's Paul Huttner.
Kathy Werzer and NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner about Paul's memories from 1965. And that is the NPR News Update for this Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi, back with the Minnesota News on Thursday.